Just the other night, at a hometown football game, my wife and I ran into my old high school flame. And as I introduced them, the past came back to me, and I couldn't help but think of the way things used to be. She was the one that I'd wanted for all times, and each night I'd spend praying that God would make her mine. And if he'd only grant me this wish I wished back then, I'd never ask for anything again. Sometimes I thank God for unanswered prayers. Remember when you're talking to the man upstairs, that just because he doesn't answer doesn't mean he don't care. 'Cause some of God's greatest gifts are unanswered prayers. Wasn't quite the angel that I remembered in my dreams, and I could tell the time changed me in her eyes too, it seemed. We tried to talk about the old days, there wasn't much we could recall. I guess the Lord knows what he's doing after all. I looked at my wife, and then and there I thanked the good Lord for the gifts in my life. Sometimes I thank God for unanswered prayers. Remember when you're talking to the man upstairs, and just because he may not answer doesn't mean he don't care. Some of God's greatest gifts are unanswered. Some of God's greatest gifts are all too often unanswered. Some of God's greatest gifts are unanswered prayers.
Garth Brooks, Unanswered Prayers. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. In this portion of the program, The New Nashville, our guest is journalist Bruce Feiler. His new book, Dreaming Out Loud, profiles three country music stars, Garth, Wynonna, and we don't need to hear the names Brooks and Judd to understand who it is we're talking about. Wade Hayes, well, not as well known, but no doubt on his way to Wade. Wade Hayes burst on the scene in 1995, an overnight success. By his 26th birthday, he signed a record deal. His first single, Old Enough to Know Better, was a hit. Our guest this afternoon, Bruce Feiler, spent countless hours with these three artists over the course of a couple of years, getting to know Wade Hayes as his success was just beginning. Garth Brooks as he was trying to understand and stay on top of success, and Wynonna Judd as she was restarting a career, this time without her famous mother, Naomi. As we talk, your questions and comments are welcome. Join us with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Outside Champaign, call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Bruce Feiler is a frequent contributor to All Things Considered. He's the author of four books, including Learning to Bow and Under the Big Top. His new book, Dreaming Out Loud, is published by Avon. Toll-free 1-800-222-9455 in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Bruce Feiler, good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon. I have to tell you, if as many times as I've heard that song, I was thinking as I was listening to it, I still would put it at the top of the list of best country songs of the decade.
Yeah, it's good.
I mean, what's so amazing about it to me is that it's such a classically contemporary country song. It's not a country song that would have been written in the 60s, because I think in the past, here's a guy who goes back to his high school football game and runs into his girlfriend, and in the past, the guy might have had an affair with a woman, or he might have left the wife, or anything, but what makes this a 90s country song is that at the end, in that wonderful line, he realizes, so he goes back to his wife, which is a sort of perfect emblem of 1990s family values.
Mm. But it's still, you know, it's still country. There's still a sense that there's something here from a good heart.
Mm.
And also that the singer who's telling us the story, you know, really has a sense for being there.
Well, I think that's an interesting comment about being there. I mean, I think that what country music, one of the things that's always done really well is to establish a sense of place. I mean, if you look at some of Garth's more famous songs, they talk about that he grew up in Oklahoma City, and actually in a suburb outside of Oklahoma City, and they are rooted in Texas and Oklahoma and in the South. I think one of what's happened to country music, and I think for better or worse, depending on who you talk to, is that the sense of place has changed, so that it's not the places that we traditionally associated with country music, the farm, the barefoot woman in the kitchen, the front porch. It becomes things like high school homecoming games or airports or fancier downtown urban centers or the sort of suburban house. And I think that what's happened to country music, and one of the reasons it's reached a much broader audience in the last decade, is that the places it now sings about are much more relevant to a broader audience, not only Southerners and Midwesterners, which had been its base. Now people in the Northeast, now people in the West, and places like that.
Yeah, now you can go and listen to country music in Seattle or in Connecticut or or in California.
I mean, at a time, I mean, that song came out in, I think, 1992, and at a time, in the mid-1980s, 55 of the top 100 cities in America, the number one rated station was a country station in places like Cincinnati and San Diego and Baltimore, in places that you wouldn't normally associate with country music, and Garth is largely responsible for that.
Mm. Now, for some time, you couldn't get far enough away from country music. What turned you around?
I grew up in the South. I grew up in Savannah, Georgia. I'm a fifth generation Georgian. To me, I hated traditional country music. It was everything about the South that I wanted to escape, or at least thought I wanted to escape. Hay bales and hound dogs and overalls. For someone who didn't grow up in that kind of environment, I hated it. I did leave the South. I lived abroad. You mentioned learning to bow, which was about 3 years I spent living in Japan. And I lived in Europe, and I came back in the 90s, and like a lot of people, found my toe tapping along to the new sound coming out of Nashville. When I was interested in the fact that it seemed to offer a place for Southerners or fallen Southerners or lapsed Southerners like me, it seemed much more relevant. And I made a few scouting trips to Nashville, and I was just amazed. I mean, the first time I went to Nashville, I spent a week sort of interviewing people on Music Row, which is sort of the headquarters of country music, like Capitol Hill is the headquarters of politics. And the only Southerner I met in a week of interviews was the only Southerner in the room, you know, and I had gone in my little preppy clothes, which I had always thought of Nashville as being somewhat of a preppy place. And in fact, what I found was that it was full of New Yorkers and people from Los Angeles fleeing the earthquakes, and it had very much of a slick sort of Hollywood sensibility to it.
Mm.
So I was just interested that here was a town that 10 years earlier had been sending out hee-haw to the world, and there certainly had been no greater cliche than hee-haw, and now was producing slick videos and was making now billions of dollars by having slightly changed its image. And so I thought, wow, this is relevant to my life as a sort of international Southerner, if you will. And so I, just the way I live my life, I up and moved to Nashville and was really embraced by the town.
Yeah. Now, some country fans are not wild at all about the new Nashville, the big hats. They say, you know, the good stuff is Johnny Cash and Merle Haggard, Hank Williams, Kitty Wells. How do you feel about that opinion?
My feeling about that is I can understand they don't like it. But at the same time, when you go back and reread the history and re-listen to the history of country music, as I've done over the last several years, it turns out that's an argument that's not particularly very new. When, in fact, you mentioned Kitty Wells, who was the dominant country singer in the late 50s and early 60s. Well, when Patsy Cline came along in the early 1960s, she was considered much spicier, much more independent woman. She cursed and drank, things that Kitty Wells never would have done. And she sang songs like, say, Crazy, you know, one of the more famous country songs of the 1960s. And it was criticized as being too pop, which is precisely the criticism you hear about, say, Winona as being too pop in the 1990s. It turns out that every 10 years, Nashville produces a new sound, whether it's honky-tonk in the 50s or this sweet strings-influenced Nashville sound of the 60s. Waylon and Willie, when they came along with their rock-infused country music in the 70s. Every 10 years, a new crop of people come up. It breathes new life into the genre, and the people who like the old stuff criticize it.
Yeah.
I mean, Johnny Cash was roundly criticized when he came up. It was considered to be too rock and roll at a time when people were turning away from Elvis, and here was Johnny Cash doing a very much of a blues-infused Memphis-style country music. The traditionalists hated it.
Yeah. I think it has a lot to do with where you are when you discover a music.
I think that's right.
You know, no matter what it is, if you came onto jazz because you like bebop, then bebop is going to be high on your list. If you came of age in the rock era when the Rolling Stones and the Beatles were at the top, you know, those are your artists and your music. And I suppose it's very much the same for country music.
And what's interesting about that is in country faces a sort of unique situation, and that is that the base of the audience has always been older people in their sort of 40s and their 50s. Right now, the traditional country audience, half of the country audience is still primarily women in their 30s and their 40s. But what's happened is that now that the country sort of caught up with the glamorization of popular culture in the 1990s, now that videos are in country music, you have sort of Garth leading essentially a young hunk movement. Garth Brooks, Alan Jackson, Billy Ray Cyrus is the classic example of that.
Yeah.
You now have Shania Twain, who's come along in the mid-1990s, who's really instituted the first of the... she's the Shania, who's from Canada, is the first of the country babes. Shows her belly button, dances around in really, really slick videos. And you now have everybody in Nashville going on diets, buying fashionable clothing, showing their midriffs. We went from Shania showing her belly button, which was scandalous in 1995, to Mindy McCready donning a belly button ring and going on Tonight Show, and they showed a close-up of it. Coming out of Nashville, where Loretta Lynn was still wearing dresses down to her ankles and wearing very traditional dresses. So I think the problem is that young people buy more records. People in their 20s and now increasingly country fans in their teens, they buy more records, but the base of the audience is still older, and the record labels tend to go where the record sales are naturally.
Mm.
I mean, you got a situation in American music where, say, rap music or hip-hop music has about 10% of the radio audience, but 20% of the sales. So that audience is buying twice as many as they are. Country's got a third of the radio market. A third of any people listening to radio right now are listening to a country radio station. But only a sixth of the record sales market. So the audience is buying only in half of its numbers. And that's a problem when you're a record company and you only make money by people buying records.
Yeah. You know, speaking of Shania, that made me think of Winona. Mm-hmm. And that made me think of the insecurity that Winona feels when she looks out on the scene and sees this skinny girl with her navel showing. And then that makes me think about Garth and Wade, that all three of these folks have a lot of insecurities.
Somebody came out when I was in Nashville last time. Somebody came up to me and said, "Why did you pick the three artists in your book who were most in need of psychiatric care?" And I said, "You know what? When I started this thing, I had no idea that these were the artists most in need of psychiatric care." I think it's. I mean, Wynonna is a very, very interesting story because Wynonna is probably the most famous woman in America about whom it can be said that everything we know about her comes from somebody else. Her mother, all through the 1980s, when the Judds were enormously popular, mother, daughter, mother, you can see the tensions we just were speaking about, mother, Naomi, in her little candy cane dresses and looking like a porcelain doll, and Wynonna, who was desperate to wear leather and color her hair really pumpkin orange and get on a motorcycle, and there was that sort of tension, and I think a lot of people reveled in that tension. But Naomi did all the talking and defined it and sort of said, well, Wynonna is a little talented brat, and she wrote this book that really sort of trashed Wynonna in a lot of situations. When Naomi retired, for whatever reason you believe, whether she was ill or not, and there's great debate about that, Wynonna was suddenly left on her own, and I think here's a woman who was 30 years old who never made a set of decisions for herself. Every decision had been made by her mother or by her manager. I mean, she told me that she didn't want anything to do with money. She couldn't decide to buy a car or a house or anything without other people not only picking it out for her, but signing the checks and making all the decisions. And she wanted to develop this identity for herself. But at this point, she was a tabloid figure. And to be a woman trying to realize who you are when you're battling with the National Enquirer and Entertainment Tonight is extremely difficult. And that's the story that I sort of watched unfold during the time that I was with her.
Yeah. You write that when she became pregnant in 1994, she lost control of the public narrative of her life. I wonder if she ever really had a grip on it to begin with.
Well, there was a very narrow window when she first went on her own in 1992 that she had a new set of handlers and her mother was off the scene, where there was a public narrative of Wynonna going out on her own. As it turns out, the behind-the-scenes story was much more poignant. I mean, there's that amazing story that Wynonna told me about one of the first nights when they were on, they used to share a bus together, and Naomi would have her bedroom, and Wynonna would have her bedroom. And one of the first nights that Wynonna went out on her own, Wynonna's nickname for her mother had been Queen of Everything. And Naomi had called Wynonna Princess of Quite a Lot.
Yeah.
And so Wynonna says, okay, well, I'm by myself now. I might as well go into the bigger bedroom, the bedroom that had belonged to Mama. And she goes in there, and there is the tiara and the scepter that she had given her mother as a sort of toy gift. And Wynonna looks at this thing on the bed, and she says, is this my mother passing the tiara and the scepter to me because I'm now queen of everything? Or is she reminding me that even though she's not there, she's still queen of everything?
Mm.
So publicly, Wynonna's handlers refused her to talk about what was going on internally, and they put out this public story, but internally, Wynonna was just absolutely melting. And so by the time she became pregnant a couple years later, she just had to retreat to her farm and try to figure it all out. And that's when she learned that remember, even at this point, Wynonna thought that that Michael Simonella was really her father. It wasn't until 1994 that Wynonna learned that the man that her mother had told her for 30 years was her father really wasn't.
So much turmoil in such a small spot of time.
Absolutely. I mean, there were times I was with the story. I mean, you were going my bio. I'd written three books by the time I even showed up in Nashville. There was a lot of time when I was dealing with Wynonna, or Planet Wynonna, as I affectionately called her, when I thought, you know what, I'm just not sure I'm up to this. I need to be Tolstoy to figure out what's going on. And we haven't even thrown in Ashley to the mix.
Yeah.
So it's a heroically, epically odd situation.
Why don't we hear a little Wynonna? I have Wynonna, the disc Wynonna and Collection, and I thought we would hear Change the World.
This is a song that was written by several songwriters in Nashville that Wynonna cut first, and her version was brilliant, and she wanted to release it, but the people at MCA did not want to release it as a single, and then Eric Clapton released a single for the film Phenomenon, and it became a Grammy-winning hit, but Wynonna had cut it first.
Okay, Change of the World, Wynonna.
If I could reach the stars, I'd pull one down for you, shining on my heart, so you could see the truth that this love inside is everything it seems. But for now I find it's only in my dreams that I can change the world. I would be the sunlight in your universe, and you would think my love was really something good. Baby, if I could change, if I could be a queen, even for a day, I'd take you as my king. I'd have it no other way, and our love would rule in this kingdom that we made.
Change the world, Wynonna Judd. That's just great.
It's amazing. I mean, the voice is one of the best voices to come out of Nashville, male or female, this century. And I think we were talking about the insecurities going into that song. My view on Wynonna is that there's every reason to believe she should be on some wacko farm in California, that she would be studying with Deepak or she would do something like that. And she has that sort of predilection. But I think in the end, she really is slave to that voice. She realizes she's a very spiritual woman. She realizes she's been given this amazing instrument, and I think that's really the only thing that has grounded her and kept her in the music business, is the desire to serve that gift that she's got.
Yeah. At some point in the book, you write about her performing and swaying to the music and being really caught up in it and feeling like she is an entire church choir.
That's exactly right. When she, I mean, here's a woman who is extremely insecure, as we've been discussing, who has got all of this turmoil surrounding her life, her husband, her father, her sister, her mother, and she's got this body which she's sometimes unable to control the weight of, but when she goes out and she sings, she is pristinely in control of herself, and you can see her consumed by the music, and she has this voice which is able to simultaneously somehow, you know, croon and sing and grunt and growl and howl and roar and roar, and it's almost as if she can sing melody and harmony at the same time in the context of her own voice.
Yeah, there's heart and soul and attitude.
Mm. Oh, attitude! Oh boy, sass is her word for it.
With Wynonna, though, there's this. Now we're talking about Wynonna. I'm thinking about Wynonna, how she calls Hollywood Holly Weird. And there's a sense in your book that Nashville is really turning into a little, you know,
right.
Holly Weird.
Right, exactly. Nash Vegas is what they call it.
Oh, yeah.
The Third Coast, that was popular for a while. I think that's right. I went to Nashville actually to a certain degree looking for the South, and I think that what I came upon was sort of Hollywood, was that new sort of franchised, almost like Planet Hollywood, Mall America, to a certain degree.
Mm-hmm.
What's happened is, I mean, we'll put this in a little bit of context. In 1970, Nashville was country music was a $200 million a year business. It was a $400 million a year business in 1980. It was a $700 million business in 1990. which means essentially, you know, it had tripled between 1970 and 1990. It then tripled again in the next 5 years to become a $2.1 billion industry by 1995. When you start bringing $2.1 billion through an industry of, oh gosh, who knows, 10,000 people in Nashville, you get dramatic extremes, people doing good things and bad things, and you also get Hollywood-style image control. Mm-hmm. Remember, Garth Brooks has sold essentially since the beginning of the decade 80 million records. That's more than any American artist in history, and behind only the Beatles in terms of total sales in North America. He's selling a million records a month. So when you get that kind of money flowing into town, you get publicists, you get handlers, you get tabloid photographers, you get covers of People magazine, you get appearances on Jay Leno and David Letterman that you never had before, and as a result, you get dramatic highs and dramatic lows. Mm-hmm. So that it used to be Tammy Wynette could sell 100,000 records, and it would be an enormous hit. Now someone like Wade Hayes comes to town, 26 years old, he's got to sell 500,000 records just to break even. So the upside, I always say this about Garth, I mean, Garth brought the rhythms of pop culture into Nashville and the rhythms of Hollywood into Nashville. The upside is if you could get the attention and get some songs that broke through, you could sell, boom, Leanne Rimes, 5 million records in a year. Shania Twain, boom, 10 million records in 2 years. The downside is if you don't make the cut, it's as brutal, and they will kick you out the door and bring in someone else to try.
And there's also this pressure to have a hit, and music companies and managers are saying to folks like Wynonna, no, let's not do Change the World.
Right.
Let's do something else.
That's exactly right. And I mean, and I actually met with the head of MCA, and who I know quite well, and I said, why didn't you release Change the World? I mean, when you put the Eric Clapton version next to the Wynonna version, I mean, to me at least, it's an advertisement for how great a singer Wynonna is. Eric Clapton's a great guitar player, and that's a wonderful song, but Wynonna's vocally is dramatically better. And he's like, you know, well, our... the people who talked to radio, they thought that it was not country enough. They thought that it would be sort of too pop or too rock. And you get into quickly the business that drives country music, which is radio. You've got 2,600 country radio stations in America, 10,000 radio stations in America. A quarter of them are country radio stations, and those people want to be country music and to try to hold this line, which is sort of a laughable line between country and pop. And that's unfortunately what drives the business. If you get it on a radio, you can get people to buy it. If you don't, people won't. And that's the name of the game right now in country music.
We're talking this afternoon with Bruce Feiler. His latest book is Dreaming Out Loud, Garth Brooks, Wynonna Judd, Wade Hayes, and the Changing Face of Nashville. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. If you'd like to join the conversation this afternoon, give us a call. Questions, comments are welcome. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. In your book, we meet a woman by the name of Debbie Flesher of Columbia, and you give us a look at what she has to do in order to get Wade Hayes on a good night on the radio. Nicole, can you give us some idea, can you give the audience some idea of how it works and how difficult it is?
You got these 2,600 radio stations I was mentioning. 200 of them, roughly speaking, report to the trade papers. That's Billboard, and that's R&R, which is Radio and Records. Those people make a chart every week of the songs, and all the other stations follow what the charts do. So getting the record onto the reporting stations, as they're called, is the number one objective of the record labels. Debbie Flesher is the head of the promotion department. She's got a team of people out in the country, six or eight people. They have to get the first single off Wade Hayes' second record. And this happens with every record, but that happens to be the record that I followed. And she gave me absolutely amazing and completely unprecedented access, which is she let me sit in her office every Monday for four months as they were trying to do this process. Monday night, the chart for R&R, which is the more important of the charts, is created. And the record stations have to submit how many times they're going to play a song, 10 times, 12 times, 15 times. And all this, two dozen record labels, 24 record labels, trying to get artists onto this chart, which is, and each record label's got about four artists, so there's about 100 artists trying to get on the chart that's only 30 people, only has 30 songs on it, so there's this incredible competition to do it. And what drives the process now is this research. They put a song on for a couple of weeks, and then the research takes over. And the way the research works, which is perhaps the most fascinating and the most horrifying thing that I uncovered, is that these radio stations are now increasingly owned by conglomerates, and the days back in the 60s where Loretta Lynn could go into a radio station, you know, give the DJ a peck on the cheek and bring a pie to the receptionist and get her song on the radio that afternoon, long gone. Now, they hire these companies, and the company, like, say, Marketing Research Incorporated, which is the company that I followed, they call 100 people but at dinner time, and they play them 6 seconds of 100 songs. That's On a Good Night, or I've Got Friends in Low Places, or Change the World. I mean, 6 seconds, that's it. And they have the people rate these songs 1 to 5. You know, 1 meaning they like it a lot, 5 meaning they dislike it a lot. Now, and basically they then tabulate all the numbers, and the numbers that rank the highest, those are the songs that get played on your radio station. This happens in country, this happens in rock, this especially happens in pop, it happens in all forms of radio. It's absolutely horrifying that you can call 100 people that we've never known, that are sort of culled from all across the country, and they get to decide. But what happens is, and what's even more disturbing about it, is the research has proven over the last sort of 6-8 years they've been doing it, that songs that people like a lot, songs that get ones, are also songs that people dislike a lot. And as a result, they get low numbers. And if you're a radio station, you don't really, and you're not an NPR station, you're ratings driven, you don't really care that people love the music that you're playing. You just care that people don't hate it enough in order to switch the channel. So what happens is, as a practical matter, they don't play the songs that get the ones, because they also get the fives. They play the songs that get the twos and threes and fours, the sort of mediocre music that will keep you waiting around for 5 more minutes, but that won't necessarily drive you to a record store to buy it.
I got to get you into that next quarter hour.
Exactly. I mean, here it is. If you listen to a radio station, there are no advertisements on the hour or the quarter hour or the half hour or the three-quarter hour, because, as you said, radio stations, unlike Nielsen TV, it's done on the quarter hour. So they always play a song over the quarter hour. And the thing is all categorized, you know. The number one song that goes on the quarter hour to get you into the new quarter hour so you record in your book. And it's especially done, whatever it is, 4 times a year that they do the books, as they called. And if people saw how this worked, it would really horrify them. And so the problem is that the radio is increasingly taking bland, non-interesting, non-challenging music, and the listeners are getting turned off. They're not buying it. So record labels are in this bind.
So, yeah, so in the long term, this is really short-sighted, isn't it?
In the long term, it's unbelievably short-sighted. So that a song like Change the World, which is a brilliant song, never gets released to radio, because radio won't play it because it's not perceived to be country, and because some of the traditional country listeners might not like it or whatever. So they don't play it. And in fact, they put out a really uninteresting Winona song in that instance 3 or 4 years ago. It didn't do well. The album ended up dying, and Change the World ended up winning a Grammy for Song of the Year, all genres of music, and being a hit for Eric Clapton. And no one knows that Winona even released it. And it all has to do with Debbie Fleischer's of the world, the promotions people whose job it is to deal with the DJs.
We should get all these folks in a room and say, "Now you guys can't come out until you clean it up."
Well, I mean there's lots of talk, because I think what's happened the last couple of years is that the radio listenership for country music has declined, because finally people are collectively starting to realize that the music is less interesting. Sales have declined, but it's the same old thing. Unfortunately, decline in success does not make people more willing to take risks. It makes them less willing to take risks. So as a result, we get more and more copycat artists. We get more and more people that are cookie-cutter artists, and the more novel people tend not to go through, and it's exactly the opposite of what should happen.
Yeah.
But the reason it's happening is because the business is being driven by money counters and bean counters. It's no longer being driven by creative people.
Let's talk about Wade Hayes. You talked with his mother quite a bit, and she told you at one point, Wade is music. So if that's the case, what about the satisfaction of the artists in facing a situation where they're pressured to record things that aren't the best?
Well, I think Wade is a classic example of what we're talking about right here, which is that Wade comes to town, and he's 26 years old. He's come from Oklahoma, and what his mother was referring to was that Wade's father was a musician, Wade's grandfather, going back to Wade's great-grandparents were on that, she told me about that Merle Haggard song called Working Your Way Back Home, One Field at a Time. They were those Steinbeckian people who left the Dust Bowl, went to California, and then came back to Oklahoma. And they had played the fiddle, and they had been migrant workers and working their way back to California. They had this music, the American soil, in their blood. Unfortunately, when Wade Hayes, 26, comes to Nashville in the early to mid-1990s, and he has all of this music in his soul, he's also a classic example of a contemporary country music artist, went to some college, really savvy about the business. He knows that it takes X number of spins on the radio to advance up the chart and to get more exposure and to sell records, and he knows all of these things, and so he becomes a chart watcher. It's a mirror of actually what's happened to Garth, who has become sort of obsessed with the numbers in the minds of a lot of people. So he begins looking over his shoulder. He knows he's only got a limited period of time in which to make a hit. He listens to all of the people who sit in a room and say, we need this kind of music. Radio wants this kind of music. He begins to produce that kind of music. It doesn't necessarily work. He gets so caught up in the numbers, he essentially has a nervous breakdown. Right at the time, in fact, that his mother told me this. And she's saying, boy, Wade, you've had a wonderful life and a wonderful opportunity. Just to have this chance is really wonderful. And Wade's like, but wait a minute, on my chart, my song is not moving up the chart fast enough. The record label's not going to spend as much marketing money. I'm not going to get as good a space in the Walmart. I'm not going to be a star. Both of them are right, but unfortunately, the more time for these younger artists they spend watching the numbers, the less time they spend writing songs, and ultimately, the less good the music becomes.
Mm. Let's take a call. We've got someone waiting for us on line 4 in Bourbonnais. Hi.
Hi. Thanks.
Sure.
I have several questions, if you please. My first question is about the older generation, Waylon and Willie and Merle and guys like that, Dolly. They seem to just not be around Nashville much anymore. What is actually happening with them? How are they making it?
The answer to that question is, I'll give you first a technical answer, which is when the country music started booming in the 90s, these research people that we talked about, what they found was that the fans of old-fashioned country music let me say this another way. The new people who'd come to the music, okay, the audience essentially tripled in size in the 90s. The new people, two-thirds of the audience, liked only the new stuff and not the old stuff. The older audience, the traditional audience, liked both the old stuff and the new stuff. So it didn't take a genius to figure if you play just the new stuff, you get everybody.
Get both.
And therefore, the radio people play none of the old stuff. So as a result, they don't have radio exposure. As a result, their record sales dropped off. Most of them, I mean, Dolly Parton's got a new record now. George Jones has put out a new record this year. Loretta is making somewhat of a comeback. They're putting out new music, but without radio exposure, people aren't buying them, and as a result, they're being dropped by their labels. So as a practical matter, they tend to play the Opry, a lot of them, which the Grand Ole Opry, which still has a radio show on Fridays and Saturdays and still is on TV on TNN for half an hour on Sundays, on Saturdays. The Opry sort of tends to be the seniors' tour, if you will.
Yeah.
So they have a career playing smaller venues. Sometimes they go to Branson or Myrtle Beach or places that cater to an older clientele. And they complain about the younger artists.
Yeah. So
that's sort of how they're they make a living. And some of them, there's a chapter in my book actually about Waylon Willie, and I spent a lot of time around Waylon in particular. And he claims not to be upset because he said, "Look, when I came along in the '70s, I had to push aside people." So when Waylon and Willie came along, I mentioned this in the last half hour, he pushed out Hank Thompson and Hank Snow from the 50s.
Right.
So the new people push out the people from the 70s. It's just the way the culture works.
Yeah, the way life goes.
Yeah.
Okay.
So anyway, some people have accepted it and some people have not. I know someone just recently tried to get me to write an article about Dolly Parton, and I said I'd love to talk to Dolly Parton about the scope of her career, and the publicist said, "Dolly wants to talk about her new music. She doesn't want to talk about the past."
Yeah.
Because she's tired of talking about the past. She wants some attention for her new work.
Well, I can't blame her for that.
Right. But the press doesn't care.
Yeah.
Wow. Do you have another question?
Yeah, thank you. Could you give us a few minutes about some of the other musics that are going on in Nashville? I know Janis Ian is there and Michael Johnson. And Nashville is a much richer environment, I think, than maybe some people realize. I
mean, that's exactly right. In fact, some great American music, in fact, some of the best American music, most interesting in terms of mix of rock and a little bit of country and some roots stuff, is coming out of Nashville. I think of people like Kim Ritchie. I actually was at a concert last night for Lucinda Williams, who wrote some country hits earlier this decade, including Passionate Kisses, a big hit for Mary Chapin Carpenter, has put out a new record called Car Wheels on a Gravel Road, which has been widely lauded as the best record of the year by Spin and Rolling Stone, a complete person who lives and thrives in the artistic community of Nashville. Nashville has essentially become what's known in Nashville as Tin Pan South, which is probably the largest gathering of songwriters in the world now lives in Nashville. Some of them write country, some of them make a living write country, but they also write all this other kind of music, and it's a huge, vibrant community of musicians who play on these country records, but then do their own stuff at night in small clubs around town. And some of the best nights one gets to spend in Nashville are when people like, I was at a night once where Tom T. Hall and Lucinda Williams and Steve Earle were all in a round together at a place called the Bluebird, a famous cafe. And boy, you got three, there's the 70s, 80s, and 90s together in one room doing songs you'll never hear on the radio.
I want to thank the caller for his call this afternoon, and we're here at the point where we've got to wrap it up. One quick question, why is Free Bird on Wynonna controversial?
The answer to that question is Wynonna was making her third solo album called Revelations, and about 4 or 5 years ago, they produced out of Nashville an album of Eagles cover songs of the Eagles, which was a hugely popular record and created a lot of hits and made people realize that doing cover songs of 60s and 70s music by contemporary country artists would be very successful.
Mm-hmm.
Wynonna covered Freebird, actually, for one of those cover albums. And then, while she was making this album, Revelations, she was in a period of great insecurity. She was pregnant with her second child. They could not come up with enough songs to fill out the album. So they took Freebird, which had been recorded several years earlier for one of these cover albums, put it on Revelations, and the album was generally very favorably regarded. Freebird was generally perceived as being a disaster, and it resulted in the album in general getting very mixed reviews.
That's interesting, because I like it. Each to his own, you'll say, huh?
People like it, but I think because of the fact that it got so caught up in her personality being unable to cut the rest of the songs, I think word got around Nashville that it was there as filler and probably didn't help its reception at all.
Mm.
So if you didn't know that and you're just responding to it musically, it's the problem of being in a small town where you know everybody's business.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Bruce Feiler has been our guest. Look for his book, Dreaming Out Loud, Garth Brooks, Wynonna Judd, Wade Hayes, and the Changing Face of Nashville.